Lord, speak. Because that was your desire for us tonight. To prepare our hearts and open our spirit. That you might engraft your word of truth. To open our understanding. Because that is a work of yours. And we acknowledge this. For you choose the paths to walk and dwell in of your own accord, and no one is your counselor, but we acknowledge you as the counselor. And so, Lord, we will sit before the table that you have prepared for us tonight with hunger, with delight, with happiness, devoid of all the works of the enemy to put us to sleep, put a weariness on our mind and soul, but Lord, rather refreshed, renewed. Let us now look with eagerness and attend to your words as you speak, and let them be life unto us. Let them call to us, a call to action, a call to acknowledge you in your ways. And as often you do, Lord, you use lips of clay, but it pleases you to do this. And so until our eyes shall see thee, we will walk by faith. By the eyes of your Spirit, I bless and thank you for it, for thine it is, and thine we are. Wonderful Spirit of the Lord, that falls afresh on each and every one of us. Well, the Spirit and the Word agree. They walk together. They move and have their being together. And so they won't be in conflict tonight. Beginning in 1 Kings chapter 3, I would like to begin here. Not long after the conference had ended, one of the brethren from Argentina spoke a word and read his text, did not preach on the text, preached on something else, and then I came back and preached on his text the next Sunday. The word that the Lord had for us is connected to the word this evening. And basically, it is the reality of the Lord and His temple. The Lord is here. Of course, at this point, we cannot see Him, but the Lord is here. And that is the difference between the temples of the pagan, those who worship other gods, those who go to other churches. But where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. There is a liberty for the Spirit, not a liberty for us. I often thought that that liberty where the Spirit is the liberty for us, but it's a liberty for Him where He is. And tonight I'd like to reach back into the Old Testament and finish in the New. And fortunately, we won't read everything in between. Verse 3, chapter 3, 1 Kings. And Solomon loved the Lord. You know, there's a lot of things said about Solomon, but very few times is there a reference like this. And many people might remember King Solomon for a lot of things, but the Lord wanted him remembered for this. And the Holy Spirit inspired the prophets and the writers of the Old Testament to write, and as they were inspired by the Spirit, they wrote, of course. And the Lord also preserved this word throughout the past times of history and the many times and occasions where they wanted to destroy the word and make it void. They weren't able to take away this portion from the word. This a little verse could simply slip away from the rest, and it'd be very easy for portions of this to disappear. But the Lord was very careful to keep and to engrave every and each portion that he would use as the years and the decades and the centuries would pass by. And this is one little detail that the Lord wanted to leave here for us to know and document, for us to understand. Because unless we know this, it will not bring balance to what we want to say about Solomon. But it is said of Solomon that he loved the Lord. And other kings, some of his sons, didn't have this testimony. But it was directly said that they did not fear the Lord, nor walked in the ways of their father, or David, and that they displeased the Lord. And some of them had even went on to say that they did continuously evil in the sight of the Lord. And they served him not, nor worshiped him, nor acknowledged him not. But this is not the case of Solomon, who inherited the throne from his father, and continued on to build a temple which his father had asked him to build after he deceased. And Solomon, it says, loved the Lord. And that's a testimony of the Lord. And he was walking in the statutes of David, his father. Solomon was walking in the statutes of David, his father. Right here I would have liked it said of Solomon that he walked in the statutes of his God. But he walked in the statutes of his father, and his father David walked in the statutes of the Lord his God. You see, Solomon had David, his father's God. But to begin with, different than David, who had his own God. Of course, he was nourished at the feet or the teachings of Samuel the prophet. He was instructed by Nathan. He was guided by many of the men of God. But he found his way alone out in the wilderness. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him long before he ever met Samuel, long before anything like this, not met him, but I mean was instructed or taught or taken on by Samuel and by others. But the Spirit of the Lord was always with this lad. And he was a man who developed before the Lord. He worshiped the Lord long before he was king. Long before he served the Lord, he loved the Lord. And he not only loved the Lord, but David was a man after God's own heart. And he wasn't by far a perfect man. He wasn't by far what we would call a sinless man. But David was a man after God's own heart. And David knew the Lord. And David walked with the Lord. And David walked in the statutes and the principles and in the word and in the ways of the Lord. And this pleased the Lord. And the Lord did bless him. Now Solomon, it says, that he walked in the statutes of his father. And these were right, they were good, for they were the statutes of God. But I want you to notice several details about Solomon. Solomon was led mainly by man and not by God. His counsel he found in his own self. He asked for wisdom so that wisdom would be present within him to be able to guide people and to be able to guide God's people. And the Lord was pleased with this, that he didn't ask for anything personal. And this you'll find takes place just a few verses after the one mentioned here. And God appears to him in a dream just shortly after the scripture is quoted. And Solomon goes up in a dream before the Lord. The Lord appears to him and asks him what it is that he really wants. And he asks from this God of so great favor, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, to be able to guide the people of the Lord before whom he was placed. And he felt like he really wasn't capable of leading on. And the Lord was pleased, like I said, with him. But there was something about Solomon all along that although he loved the Lord and walked in the statutes of his father, he had this thing. And the scriptures are careful to record what this thing was. Only, it says, only. Would to God when the scriptures were written about some of us and our life history was condensed to a verse, the bad parts were put into an only category. Because of David, it says that he did the will of the Lord in everything save, that's the only. And I'm sure that many of us wouldn't have that same hope or faith that Solomon could have counted on. Nonetheless, the only is there to teach us. The only was mentioned not to mar his name, nor to bring sorrow upon the family line, nor to bring out the things that are not right, but rather for our admonishment. And the apostles of the New Testament taught that these things were placed there for us as an example, that we should not walk in those ways, and the ways that were wrong for others are wrong for us, and the things that were right for them are also right for us. And it was right, for God gave testimony that Solomon loved the Lord, And we should walk in that example. We should follow that example. We should love the Lord our God, for this is the first commandment, that we should do it with all our heart, all our mind, all our soul, and love our neighbor as ourself. And God, who set that standard in heaven, Solomon followed it, and it was wonderful to see that it could be said of him that he loved the Lord. I would love it said of me if God ever wrote anything about me, that I love the Lord, because that is a very wonderful thing to be said of someone, that they love the Lord. Nonetheless, although he did not walk in the statutes of his God, he did walk in the statutes of the God of his father. Now this he had. The only thing that God really published against him. Now the prophet came to him and personally told him of some other things that are written later, but they're all tied into this. It all begins right here. It's all here in a nutshell. He said only he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was a great high place. And he didn't just sacrifice a little bit. He sacrificed like a king would sacrifice. He did it really in style. And he said that he sacrificed 1,000 burnt offerings. And he put them upon the altar there. And what altar was that? Gibeon was the mountain upon which the tabernacle of Moses was still erect. And remember that there was two forms of worship. During the time of David, during the time of Solomon, and thereafter shortly, until the temple was finally completed, and until there was a shift over completely from the tabernacle to the temple. But you remember that the tabernacle of Moses was pitched and placed at Gibeon. And this is what Solomon went up to worship. But remember that the form of worship had been changed during that time. During the time of David, his father, the ark no longer dwelt at the tabernacle of Moses. You recall that it had been taken away during a long time, during the time of war with the Philistines. The Philistines had taken the Ark of the Covenant, and when they came, they worshipped in an empty tabernacle. They worshipped, they came, and they offered sacrifices and things like this, but you must remember that the blood was not upon the mercy seat. God said, I will speak with you from the mercy seat, and there will I dwell, and there will I be in the midst of you, and there will I judge, and there will sin be dealt with. And it was as the mercy seat had blood upon it that the enemies of Israel could not come against them, and they were covered. Their sins were covered, literally covered. And although they did sin, God did forgive. They found mercy in his sight, and God accepted the sacrifices. He accepted the animals whose precious lives were taken just for the purpose of the covering of sin, not to eat them or anything else. They just wasted them there. And what they were doing is that they were taking animals up there and they were wasting them. They weren't eating them. God wasn't getting anything out of it. Their blood wasn't applied on the mercy seat because the Ark of the Covenant wasn't there, and it was an empty ritual. The blood, the precious blood that to God was the blood to be put upon the mercy seat that it might cover the law, that God's wrath should not be upon them any longer, was not there. And so it had no significance. It was an empty ritual. Sometimes I've heard the word that people, or pastors, sometimes evangelists, fear the word emotions, and they just don't want to have a service where emotions get out of hand and where people fall out, as they call it. Now it's fall down, but they used to call it fall out, where people just get so excited they just get out, I guess, from under their skin. I don't know what falling out really is. All I know is that they just need excitement galore. But you see, emotion is one thing and emotionalism is another. Because emotion has an end. It leads to something. It has a completion. It is completed in him. It's a pouring out at his feet. But his feet were there to pour it out upon. And there was a difference, of course, in emotionalism, because emotionalism is something that you pour out from your emotions and have nothing in return, nothing that comes back. When you go to a ballpark and root for all your friends, or say like the Braves in baseball, you sit there and you yell and shout and carry on. Now that's emotionalism, because they lost, like they most times do. And so what did you get out of it? Nothing. And so after stirring it all up and hyping it all up and putting it all out, that was it. There's nothing in return. It's not completed. It's not a completed circle. It's nothing that was poured out in return. But with God, it's different. That is why I've never been afraid of emotions in church. however they be displayed, or however, to whatever degree they are displayed. Because if they are emptied out on the Lord, if they are poured out to Him, then the waters of Bethlehem found a good use. But to come back to the tabernacle, all the death of these animals and all the remembrance of sin was brought there when they killed these animals. But there was no remembrance made of mercy. There was nothing, absolutely nothing, that reminded God of the death of Jesus Christ. There was nothing on the mercy seat. There was absolutely nothing there. Now you must remember that at that time, David brought the mercy seat and even offered sacrifices, because there was another tabernacle, not just Moses' tabernacle, which was at Gibeon, but there was a tabernacle at Jerusalem. And that's what they called Mount Zion, and that's why Mount Zion became famous, because it was just a little tent. There wasn't much of a tabernacle. It didn't even have three sections, the outer court, the holy place, and the holiest of all, where the Ark of the Covenant would actually be, and the Shekinah glory of the Lord did shine as in a cloud and a pillar of fire by night. They didn't even have that. All we know is that it was just a simple tent. What it was made out of, we don't even know. At least, I don't remember ever having studied of it. But the importance wasn't in the tent, nor was there any importance in the scriptures laid upon it. And when later reference was made, even in the New Testament, it didn't go on about what it was made out of and how many poles it had and how big it was and how square or long it was, but rather that the Ark of the Covenant was there. And Mount Zion became extremely famous because the Ark of the Covenant was there. The Lord Himself was present in that place. And the difference now between Mount Gibeon and Mount Zion or Jerusalem was that the Lord was present in one of the tabernacles and He was absent at the other tabernacle. Now Solomon, during the whole time, during the course of time, brought in the tabernacle. He went to worship to the empty tabernacle. He went and worshiped where God wasn't. He went and worshiped in a place that was forms that God had established. Yes, God had established them. And at one time He was in them. At one time the presence and the person of God were there, of Jesus Christ, later called, were there, the Lord. And the glory of the Lord was there. And His person filled the place. He spoke personally to each and every one of them. He came and appeared to them. And He spoke to them. And it was a personal relationship. And out of this we hear David saying one thing. If Solomon had had his father's God, he would have said the same thing. Because David's passion, David's great thing in life, was to have a place where God would dwell. That's why he laid up so much gold and laid up so much wood and made so many preparations, because he wanted to build a place for God to dwell. He wanted to build a more permanent place for God to dwell. But he had the secret, and that was that God was present. The ark, the place where God had chosen to dwell and said that He would, he had it in his midst and would not live without it. He went in search of it. He wondered where it was. And when it was found, he had it brought back. And you will remember what happened when they brought it back. They're just, dear man, this eyes have touched the ark, and we look upon him as a man. They're, oh, how terrible, what a wicked man. But you know, that's something very easy to do. It's sometimes it's just an instinct. They hadn't had the ark in so long that the fear of the Lord that went with it just wasn't present. Who knows how long it had gone on. Maybe he was a little child. Maybe it was never instilled in him. Maybe it was never taught to him. Maybe he was never taught to reverence that presence. Maybe he never knew that it was holy. Maybe he never knew that in that box God was. Maybe he didn't know that the glory of the Lord was so powerful and so strong you couldn't reach out and touch it. You couldn't possibly get in the way of it and try to upright it. Later on, David found out that it wasn't the fact that the man touched it, but the fact that they were bringing it. They'd taken the staves out and they were not carrying it on the shoulder of the priest as God had commanded. And when he discovered this, he grieved at heart. Nonetheless, he just would not leave the matter alone. David continued on until he brought the Ark of the Covenant home, until he had it right there. Now, there's two ways you can go about this. One is that you can bring the Ark of the Covenant home, or you can bring your home to where the covenant, the power of God and the dwelling place of the Lord are, where the Lord is present, where He dwells, where He is. For most of us, we've packed up and sold houses and lands and things and moved where the ark was. In David's case, he moved the ark to where he was. He brought it to his house. It was something that he could do. It was something in his power to do. But today, it would be no different for us who left everything to live and dwell around the Ark of the Covenant, around the place where the Lord himself has put his name and where he dwells, because there is a place in which God dwells, and there are places in which God does not dwell, where he does not make himself present, where he will not be there, where he refuses to make himself known. And we're not speaking of buildings here. We're speaking of buildings made of flesh. We're speaking of buildings, a made-up building by God, a creation of God. We, each one of us, as we have said, are a creation of God. Each stone fitly framed together, put together, and God dwelling in the midst of them. He puts his name there, and he himself decides to presence himself and be there, where they're gathered together in his name, where he puts his name upon them, and he puts his name there that he might dwell there, because they are his possession and they are his dwelling place. And so back to the God of Solomon. Solomon had his father's God. What was his father's God? He was a God present. He was a God that dwelt in the midst of his people. He was a God who presenced himself in a very real way. And David had this thing. He said, I've got it down to just one thing have I desired of the Lord. One thing have I desired of the Lord. Now when God, I'm going to leave David now and go back to Solomon. When God meets with Solomon, just the next verse here, says in verse 5, in Gibeon, now here he was offering the sacrifices to an empty tabernacle. But now look at the strange thing. The Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream, not in the tabernacle, not while he was offering a sacrifice, but later, when he was sleeping, when he was in his own tent. Solomon didn't go where God was. God came where Solomon was. One thing is to serve the Lord and to wait on the Lord, and other things for the Lord to wait on you and to serve you. That's a totally and entirely different story. And these things are put here for our admonition and our teaching. Understand what God wants to say to us. God is saying, you come to me. That was David's thing. Now here, the Lord comes to Solomon, because Solomon definitely didn't come to the Lord. And God asked, if you had to get it down to one thing, now I'm paraphrasing, if you had to get it down to one thing and you were to ask of me what this would be, what would it be? I didn't see where God made it so broad that he could ask 15 different things. But the Lord appeared to him in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give thee. Now Solomon said, thou hast showed unto the servant David, that is my father, great mercy, according as he walked before you in truth and in righteousness and uprightness of heart with thee. Now notice this. Sometimes the little words are the big ones. Walked in uprightness with thee. And thou hast kept for him this great kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. And now, Lord, listen to this, Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child, and I know not how to go out or come in, and that thy servant in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, is a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore, now here it is, give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to know his ways. Moses said, show me thy ways that I might know thee. David said, one thing have I desired of thee. Now he had it down to the one thing. What was it? That he might inquire of his temple, of the Lord, that he might see the beauty of his holiness, that he might be in the presence of the Lord. That was his very longing. He got it down to that one thing. And the Lord granted him that one thing all his life. Whereas Solomon wanted understanding, not to know the ways of the Lord that lead to him so that he might know him, not to have God as his own friend, but he had ruling in mind. He had the kingdom in mind. He had people in mind. Now Solomon loved the Lord. But his great ambition, his great desire in life, was to become capacitated, if I can use that expression, to become capable of ruling, to have the wisdom to rule such a great people as this, because they were a great people. After all, they were God's people. And he was put in charge of God's people. And not only are they the most wonderful people in that God has called them and that they have such a marvelous calling from God, but they can be the most stubborn, the most hard-headed people. I mean, Moses found this out right away. And he was saying, wait just a minute. He said, I see that Moses had problem and you know, all the rest of them. Abraham even had problem when he had 7 or 8 of them. And then, you know, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. By the time they got to me, it's so big, I can't even count them or number them. And he said, look, I've been given a job to do. I feel like I'm not up quite to doing it. So this one thing I want, make me capable of walking before your people and instructing them and being wise in my judgment for them so that I might be king. And it pleased the Lord that he didn't ask him for money. And that he didn't ask him for one thing or another, a personal gain. But rather what he asked for him was for his people's sake. But now notice a tendency here. When Solomon comes before the Lord, I mean before the temple, he comes before a temple without a Lord. He comes to a temple without the Lord himself there present. And so the Lord has to go looking for Solomon. And when he finds them, he grants him the desire of his heart. And here's Solomon. So Solomon decided he'd do something even better. Solomon decided that without ever God asking him to do this, he just thought he'd do God a favor. And I've heard this expression so many times, save X amount of people for the Lord, save the world for Christ, build a church for Christ. There's so many things that are happening for Christ. My question is, did Christ ask him to do it? Well, here's Solomon now. He's building himself a temple. His dad had asked him to take all this that Nathan had clearly said to him that he shouldn't do and that he couldn't do and God wouldn't let him do. And more so, the Lord said, I don't dwell in houses made by a man's hands. He said, well, you know, the heavens aren't big enough to contain me. The earth isn't big enough. Certainly the oceans aren't deep enough. The whole universe isn't big enough. I fill all of it at one time. And he said, well, certainly a little house you build me, that's no big deal for me. So he said, don't even worry about it. Well, Solomon wasn't there to hear it. Solomon was just there to hear that his dad had an ache to have a house for God so that he could have a God there. The difference is that Solomon forgot the part of his God there or a place for God to dwell. He got concentrated on God's house. And so Solomon forgets the Lord, and he's down here building a house. And a magnificent one as it is. Queens and kings from other nations and places came and saw this magnificence of both temple and purity and gold and valuous precious stones and things happening there that they hadn't seen in any temple anywhere. They thought, goodness sakes, these people really have it put together. They must have some God. Now Nathan came and said to David, no way. What did David have? David had a simple place where the presence of the Lord was. Let me put it a different way, where the Lord presently was. That's the difference between Gibeon and Mount Zion. Now on Mount Zion, we have something else in Jerusalem. Being built as a gorgeous, beautiful temple. When they finished it, everything was perfect, immaculate. It was a work of art like you wouldn't believe. Solomon, the great king, had gone renowned and famed by then over so many things. One is by almost chopping a baby in half. How you can become famous for that, I don't know. Maybe it's because he didn't do it. But here he was. He sacrificed like he'd always sacrificed. The altars were just flowing in blood. The burnt offerings everywhere could be smelled for miles around. They did things in style. The ark was now taken from around the corner from David's house, because he wasn't around anymore, and put in this monstrous, glorious temple. Solomon says, all right, God, now I want you to come to where I and my work is. And the condescension of God, the marvelous condescension of God. Was that God's idea? No. Did God want it done? No. Did man want it done for God? Yes. Did the man that wanted most to do it ever do it? No. Did his son do it? Yes. God had promised him a son who would sit upon a throne, but it wasn't Solomon, because he said everlastingly, and that could only be Christ. And so here we are. He built a house, but look at the condescension of God. As the singers began to sing, the players began to play on their instruments, the glory of the Lord came down upon that house. So was the glory of the Lord that they couldn't even minister. Because, listen to this, of the glory of the Lord was there in that place. The Ark of the Covenant was taken to that place. Now I want to take you to Acts, if you would turn to Acts chapter 15 and read with me here. I'm going slow here because the whole idea is that you get it. Verse 14, Acts 15. Simeon hath declared how God at first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. And to this agree the words of the prophets as written, it is written, after this I will return and will build again. After this I will return and build again. What? Where was the ark? I thought the ark was in the temple of Solomon. Where was the ark? After they went into captivity, this supposed house for God got destroyed. Now, if I recall correctly, isn't it written that if God doesn't take care of a house, in vain they take care of it, and if he doesn't build it, in vain they build it? Does it say the king doesn't sleep at night and he takes care of all that's his? Does it occur to you for just a few moments that God might have been sleeping for 20 minutes and that's why they did in his temple? Do you know that there is no record that the presence of the Lord was there because no one went to him? But rather the glory of the Lord was manifested in that place. God had said that he would dwell amidst the cherubims. They had priests that did their thing. But God said, to this agree the word of the prophets. So this was from the Old Testament. That in his time, from Amos 9, in his time, he said, I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. And I will build. Who helped tear it down? His son, David. He took the ark from that tent and put it in a temple that got destroyed. But now look, during the time that David lived, now let me take you back a little bit. There were two tabernacles. One represented the formal worship. You know, in our day today, we have, in Christianity and in Christian circles, we have two tabernacles. God does not indwell the one, but he does indwell the other. He does make himself manifest in the other. He is alive and is there present in the other. But which is the first? It's the formalism. People come, they get entertained. It's Christian words, Christian Bible preaching, Christian preachers, the best Bible school can afford, Christian Bible schools, the best of professional singers that are Christians. And if you ask any of the professional singers that are Christians, they'll tell you they sing for the Lord. Maybe the Lord wasn't in a mood to be sung to. I don't know, but they do it. How can you sing to someone that's not there? Send them a tape. The ark was not there at the tabernacle of Moses. It once was. It once had the glory, but later was left with just the shell, just the forms of the same worship. Every great move of God began the same way. You know, people compare themselves one to another, the Baptists probably to the Episcopalians or the Anglicans or whoever, and the Methodists to someone else, and then the Pentecostals, they'll compare themselves to the Methodists or Baptists, and they'll say they're dead, and the Baptists will say the Anglicans are dead, and the Anglicans will say the Catholics or who knows were dead, and this goes on and on and on. Because each one bears a resemblance of more life. But you know, each one of those that today are called denominations, when they began, had the Ark of the Covenant in it. God was there present with them. And then something happened with the Ark. Something happened with that temple. Something happened with that tabernacle. And the Ark was taken from it, or the Ark was no longer in it, but the tabernacle remained. And so it becomes an empty form, an empty ritual. And there it was. That's what Solomon went up to, that empty ritual. The life was not there, the Lord was not there, but they carried on anyways if he was. I don't know what the priest did when they went into that empty room inside. I don't know. I haven't asked him. I don't think there's anything that mentions what they did or didn't do. But we do know that they offered to the Lord sacrifices there in the high places. And later on they had other high places, but this was the high place. And they didn't offer them to other idols, but unto the Lord. It's no wonder that the prophet letter said obedience is so much better than sacrifice. Just do what he would like you to do. Forget trying to do something that you would like for him to accept. But you see, this is the emptiness of formality. Do you know that it's easier? Do you realize that the scriptures say that all Israel worshipped in high places? They took sacrifices and they offered them in high places. All Israel, all the people, not just Solomon, but all the people. David and a few were those that came and walked with the Lord, talked with the Lord, lived with the Lord. The Lord was present in their midst, and Sinai and Zion was famous for the glory of the Lord and for the presence of the Lord. They had a different ritual. There was always dancing. There was singing. There was worship. There was expression. Whereas in the other, it was a ritual. You did your thing. Hardly any noise, except maybe an animal bawling before it had to die or give up life or who knows what. But it wasn't really the type of excitement that there was at Mount Zion on the sides of the north of Jerusalem. It was just a different thing. It was a totally different story. As the gates of heaven were opened there, the person of Jesus were there. It was something that was alive. The presence of Christ was there. There was praise. There was worship. There was dancing. There was liberty. There was life. There was singing. It was just explosive. It was life-filled. And David loved the Lord and walked with the Lord and walked in his ways and walked wherever he was. And if he couldn't do that, he brought the Lord where he was. You see, that was in his heart. But here's this empty shell. Today, the Christian church, not just in the United States, but everywhere in the world, is divided that way. It's divided in the formalism, because in the formalism you can do the same thing, but you don't have to answer to him because he's not really there. And it's much easier. You just come, you get entertained, or you just follow the songs they tell you to sing, and if you forgot them because you're not really minded to keep them in mind, well, you can always read them on a wall anymore. And so we just follow along and do our thing, go home, we've accomplished something, but it's a dead ritual. It's an absolute dead ritual. The Lord dwells in the midst of his people. He said, I will build a tabernacle that hands of man can't build. He said, I will build it. Ye are those lively stones that are built together, a holy temple unto the Lord. And he himself is there to dwell there. And he is the one that speaks. He is the one that gives orders. He is the one that is worshipped. He is the one that is loved. He is the one that's there present. Absolutely and truly there present. The other is formalism. He was once present. But when he's not anymore, folks, you have to go on, you know. On where? On where? You know, I was reading today a simple scripture. I'd never really caught it that way. We were talking about serving the Lord. And the pastor from Hawaii, Les Brown, was talking to us about serving the Lord, waiting on the Lord. But Jesus said something very interesting. He said, he that will serve me, let him follow me. That wherever I go, he will go, he may go also. What is that saying? What is that suggesting? That when God's through with the form and through with the tabernacle and moves to another one, do we stay with the tabernacle or do we stay with the Lord of the tabernacle? Does he put his name on things forever? Where his name once dwelt, today they're just a denomination. What happened to his dwelling? Because they didn't follow on. The Lord followed on into other levels, and they just couldn't go up there with him, so they quit following. So now you can't serve him. You can't wait on him. You can do a lot of things for the Lord. Send it by mail. Send him a cassette. Tell him how much you love him. But he's not in that tabernacle. That's why he said the true worshiper shall worship him in spirit and in truth. For only where he is there life, for he is life. And apart from him, there is no life. There can be a form of life. There can be a similarity of life. But he said, without him, there is no life, for he is life. If this is an organization, I want to be gone from it when he walks out of it. When this becomes a form, I want to either be gone from this world or gone from that place. Because from what I can see, God loved to dwell in a tent, but he wouldn't live in a rigid temple. Why? Because he couldn't move. A tent, you just take down two poles, fold it up, and pitch it up somewhere else. Horacio was telling me the other day that poor Pastor Lacovara, when they went down to a beautiful place, it's the second Swiss Alps of the world, down in Argentina, that other pastors that were there and gone on a vacation decided they'd go from one place to another every day. And this poor guy, I don't know how many times he had to pitch and unpitch and pitch and unpitch his poor tent. But by the third or fourth day, he said, that's it. That's it. I'm planting my tent down. You guys can all die out there or do whatever. I'm not pitching and unpitching my tent anymore. That's it. Well, I don't know how many times the Lord moves. But if I ask a show of hands from everybody here tonight present, that didn't begin in this state or didn't come from this state or didn't come to this church from this state, probably two-thirds or more of the hands would go up. You see, because it's not just a geographical following. It's also something greater than that. And that is that you could be right here, but the Lord move from level to level and we not move with him. I remember 1987, just to give you a reference point, there was an awful lot of us that found it hard to make it to that reference point where he was walking. That was just more than we wanted to stomach or handle. And we have this song that we sing, I will follow the Lamb. And he said, whosoever will serve me, let him follow me. That is why he lives in a tabernacle. Why? Because it's not only a moving that's geographical, but it's a moving that's spiritual and onward in our development with Christ. And he will not leave us leaving forever on a mountain. He did come, you know, and said, all right, you've been long enough on this mountain. Pick up the stakes. I don't care what you're fussing about with your tents, but unpitch them and pitch them. Let's move. When they were on the wilderness, the glory of the Lord, the cloud would rise above the tabernacle and move to another place. And they had to pick up everything and take down everything and drag it over to where it was under that cloud and where that cloud would take them to. And when the cloud would rest and stop his movement, that's where they stayed. I don't know what God was minded of when he moved from one place to another. All I know is that they had to follow the cloud. That is why he lived in a tent. And you know, when it became fixed on Gibeon, when they put the tabernacle up there and they'd lost the glory of it, do you know that it never moved? Why? Because the cloud that made it move was no longer there. And you say, well, the cloud did away with the wilderness. The tabernacle was done away with in the wilderness, really, when they went into the Canaan land and all the rest. Look, you can make up any stories you want to. All I'm telling you is that the presence, the dynamic person of the Godhead was not present there. God said, I'm going to restore David's tabernacle. I'm going to restore it in a place where people will walk with me, where I'm free to move, where they're free to move with me, where I am in the midst of them, and I dwell in the midst of them, and I'm loved in the midst of them, and I love in the midst of them. Where God is alive, where he is real, where his spirit is there to manifest himself without an air of help from anyone. And the prophets announcing that the Lord would again restore the tabernacle of David. The music, the worship, the singing, the prophetics, all this alive where the presence of the Lord is. Now we'll end this evening in the book of Revelations. In the first chapter where John was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and he heard behind him a voice as of a trumpet saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, and the 11th verse, first and the last. But thou seest, write in a book, and send it into the seven churches which are in Asia, Ephesus, and Smyrna, Pergamos, and Thyatira, and Sardis, and Philadelphia, and unto Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that spake unto me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one. Did you hear that? In the midst of the seven candlesticks, one, like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, girded about his waist with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, white as snow, and his eyes were as flames of fire. His feet like unto brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice is the sound of many waters. Where was he manifested like this? The Spirit of the Lord moved upon John and said, write. Write to the seven churches. What you see. What did he see? He saw seven golden sticks, candlesticks, and one in the midst of them. We go on now in verse 16. He had in his right hand seven stars. And I'm going to go on now real quick. And it says, and when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. Now go down to verse 20, halfway into 20. And the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven candlesticks which thou sawest are the seven churches. Now I'm going to ask you a question. Who was in the midst of the church? One like unto the Son of Man. How was he manifested? With eyes as flames of fire. John said that when he saw him, do you realize that the only thing that has happened here is that we cannot see him? Jesus, until then, people, when he lived in this earth, people came and they touched him and they thronged around him by the hundreds, maybe thousands. One woman even touched him and was healed. He even said unto many that they could touch him. He even touched people. He laid his hands on them. Sometimes he just made mud and put it on people's face. There was that personal contact. When Magdalene came to the sepulcher when Jesus Christ rose from the grave and was alive once again, she didn't realize that he was alive, but when he made himself known to her and she realized that that was Jesus Christ that was in the midst of her and she hadn't recognized him and she didn't know that it was he, but he was there in the midst of his church, but not visible. Listen to this. She went out to touch him like anyone would when they meet someone they love again. And he said, touch me not. Touch me not, for I have not gone unto the Father. You see, what was once common, because Jesus had come in the flesh. Look, the presencing of God in this earth has been as clear as a human being like me, right standing before you. That's how clear and how manifest God was on earth with his church and his people. He was literally and actually seen in the flesh, because his flesh was flesh like ours. And they could touch him. But now listen to this. Two things were taken from us after he died, but not three. He said to Mary Magdalene, touch me not. And in the ascension, it's recorded in Acts and in other places, it said that as he rose up into the cloud, he went out of their sight. We can no longer see him. we can no longer touch, physically touch him. But he is in the midst of the candlesticks, and he is here right now. You cannot touch me. You cannot see me. But I am here right now. And I want to finish this by saying from the second chapter of Revelations, unto the angel of the church of Ephesus write these things, it saith, he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, he that holdeth the pastor, the angel of the church is in his hand. And listen to these words, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. John's eyes were open when he was in the Spirit, because our physical eyes can't see him. From time to time, the Lord will open our eyes and we'll have an open vision because he lets us see into the spirit world, but we will see the Lord here because he is here. He has put his name here. He has vowed to be here. He's dwelling here. And when our faith can reach out a little bit to touch him, even like tonight, he was there from the moment you came into this building, his spirit was here. But we have a way of thinking that when his anointing is here, it's like a little nice cloud that he sends down to make you feel happy. Who is the one that walks in the midst of the churches? Did it say who walked past? Who will walk future? What does it say? Who walketh ever present? Who continues to walk in the midst of his people, a people he calls by name, because he will restore the tabernacle of David, which is a place where he dwells, where he is manifested, where he is presently made known. It is the desire of God to make himself known. It is the desire of God to dwell in the midst of his people. Way back into history, you read God wanting to dwell in the midst of his people and how he could find a way to do it, and finally finds a man as Moses to lead his people into the midst of the wilderness that God might dwell in the midst of his people. It's his desire to manifest himself to us. And when you begin to feel that anointing in that presence of the Lord, you may not be able to see him and you may not be able to touch him, but I want to tell you, the same one who John saw, if your eyes were open, you would see one before whom you would absolutely fall. Sometimes when he is here, he manifests his holiness in such a way you can't even stay on your feet. I mean, you cannot. Sometimes his power is so great that most of us can't even stay standing. I mean, it's not like you will to. It's not like you're thinking about it. But I think sometimes that we lose sight of reality. And that's where I want to finish tonight. Because the tabernacle at Gibeon, which was the tabernacle of Moses, which once had the life of the glory and the presence of God in it, but now was empty and dead, was formalism. Was what we'd call today Christian worship, but God is not there. He said the seven candlesticks, not all the candlesticks. But what was David's tabernacle representing? Reality. Reality. God present there. Now David had something very similar to us. He could not touch him. He could not see him. But every other manifestation of God was given unto him, because God was there. Their enemies could not touch them. They could never defeat them. The glory rested upon all of them. The presence of the Lord delighted them day after day after day. David said it was better than 1,000 years out there in the tents of wickedness to dwell for just a moment in his very glorious presence. That must have been some manifestation of the presence of God. Do you know how much God wanted to presence himself to us before we ever got to heaven, while we're still in this domain of death and suffering? He came down and was made flesh. That's the absolute presencing of God. He could not make himself more manifested to us than to become just like us. He said, see, touch me. See that I am the same one. Do you think I don't know, he said to Thomas, touch me later? I was just bringing a principle out. We cannot physically touch him because he's gone. In the flesh, he's gone. He's waiting up there until all his enemies be made his footstool, but I have great news for you. He, in the flesh, is coming back to earth. And when he does, when this Son of Man does, he's going to come back as John saw him, with eyes as fire. Gold and white and light, his appearance that becomes so fearful that people tremble. They'll ask for the mountains to fall in on them, not to behold the glory of the God of heaven, made flesh on earth, and dwelling once again on earth, dwelling in this life. I may not see him, I may not feel him, with my touch, physical touch, but my spirit senses and acknowledges that he is here. I would like every eye, if you would please, close them, only to keep the other distractions away. Jesus said to Simon, I came in here tonight, and you did not wash my feet with tears. But this woman, since I came in, has not ceased to wash my feet with her tears. You didn't even wash them with water. I was here in your midst. But did you pour out your heart at all to ask me to forgive you of anything? Did you lift your voice up that I might hear it? Did you pour this ointment at my feet? He said, I've been here all night. Simon, all night I've been here. Did you once look up into my face and say, thou hast those words of life? Tonight the Holy Spirit has a choice for you. A choice between Solomon and David. A choice between the way God wants to do things and the way man does. I know it's much easier to revert back to formalism. Do you have any idea how much I fight in this place to counteract that desire in all of our hearts to just return to something more formal and easy? It is hard to stay alive and to follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes. And you know, it's not just courtesy to close your eyes, it's obedience. All it is. It's not something you cannot do, it's something you will not to do. Because you want distractions so that you don't have to face that issue and make that decision tonight. We will either be a church that lives offering sacrifices of praise and worship and song and whatever we do here to an empty tabernacle. In formalism, in rituals, just come and do our thing and leave. No demands. You don't have to walk before him. You don't have to confess before him. You don't have to life before him. You don't have to walk before him. Or we turn again for the very reason that brought you here, to sell land and home and move from wherever you came. Because I'm telling you, Christ the King, the Lord of all the earth, is here right now. And he's passing your way. You say, well, I don't see him. One day you will. Today you don't. But he's here right now. He's here right now. Our praise, our love, our tears, our songs, our worship, to receive. I want to know how we will fare when we get to heaven. And he said, I stood in your midst. But you looked the other way. You came in wondering why someone didn't finish 5 minutes earlier. He said, I was there, but you gave me no kiss. I heard not your words, whereas this woman has not ceased to weep at my feet. And because she loved much, much is forgiven her. Martha, I know that you're very careful to do all these things for us. But you see, you fit in a category of people that do a lot of things to please me. But I want you to know, if you really want to know what pleases me, what Mary does pleases me. She put it all aside when I'm there and just devoted her entire spirit and her entire life, her entire thoughts to me. That pleases me. It pleases me that you should just sit there for an hour in your life and listen to me when I speak to you, like I have tonight. That pleases me. And oh, I would that you'd be as Mary, for she has for sure chosen the better part. He is here right now. He is here right now. If you ask him, he would heal you. If you ask him, he would change you. When he appeared to Solomon, only upon his request he was granted that which he wished. I wonder tonight, what would our wish be? He is here right now. And now we're left with that decision. Will it be the tabernacle of Moses? Will it be the formality that half, if not a great percentage of our Christian country or churches in our country? It used to be a Christian country. Now there's Christian churches in this country. Do we want to be entertained? Do we want to go to an empty tabernacle? Should he change his name here, put it somewhere else? Or is this a place where we come to meet with him? Because the ark is here. The ark is here. If you have need of forgiveness, the blood is forever there. If you need to be lifed, just energy. If you lack direction or wisdom, he said, come to me and ask, and I will grant you wisdom. For he is wisdom. How about might or strength? He increases strength. He's here. I find it so hard sometimes to convey to you that he is here. Just like the three that walked the road to Emmaus. There they were, walking together. He was there, but they didn't know it. Except for a moment at the beginning of the service, he's been here, but we didn't know it. But John recorded it ever so faithfully and ever so accurately. He walketh in the midst of the seven churches, and he holds in his hands those who lead those churches. You know, that makes me weep when I hear that. Not that I am an angel to the church, but this speaks of what he does. He upholds us in his hand. Those who are his servants even, his ministers to his church. And he walks in the midst of us. Does he hear something coming from your heart? Is there an answer to these questions? Do you want to define for him tonight what it is you really want? Does it delight your heart that he would restore the tabernacle of David that was thrown down, cast down, and destroyed, replaced by something better that didn't last very long? And the ark to this day gone. No one knows where it went. But I can tell you where it is, in the midst of the candlesticks. For the wooden box was replaced by flesh. And the Word became flesh. The mercy seat is here present, ever present. And it delights my spirit tonight. It delights my spirit tonight, Lord, that you're here. Lord, take the scales from our eyes. Let us truly know that you are here. For it was your idea to manifest yourself. The self-revealing God, it was your desire to make yourself known. And what a wonderful person you are. Lord, take the fears away from us. The fears of man. But tonight you're asking us to make a choice. Where will we worship? Do we want to turn this into a temple of Solomon? Into the rigidity of formalism? Into something where we come and pay our dues and then leave? Or will it always become that special place? Not this building, our gathering together, become a special place. Where you are. Before we ever start the service, you're there welcoming them. Every person as we come through those doors. I know we come with all kinds of things on our mind, business, pleasure, all kinds of things. But I think, Lord, because it was taken away from our sight and taken away from our physical touch, we forgot to stop at the doors we entered. Said in the words so well put of that song, we are gathering together unto you. We have gathered here together unto you. We can't shake your hand. We can't even give you a hug. But we can love you. Lord, there's one thing you didn't take away from us, and that's communication. We communicate with you, and you communicate with us. Lord, you've been here standing in the midst of us tonight, opening our understanding and just saying to us, I'm here. It was my purpose that you see me not, nor can touch me with your flesh. But I am here. I walk in the midst of this church. Let us make that choice, wonderful Holy Spirit. Before we ever go tonight, to acknowledge that you are here. And that everything we do in love to you. Let not our love for you be drowned out by the formalism of our worship. Like Solomon, Lord, who loved you so. But somehow his love was overshadowed, drowned out by the ocean of ambition, by the worship of formality. What is it we do, Lord, when we come to church? Do we come to gather to a minister? Do we not realize, Lord, that all they are is just a vessel of clay that you use and speak through because we took your mouth? So now here I am, and you use my mouth. If you're going to use hands to embrace someone, you have to use mine or ours. We took yours. If there's going to be a heart of compassion that reaches out to those who are hurting, is it not going to be ours? Whose are you going to use but ours? Lord, I just want you to know that you can use my heart to love through, to weep through. If you're going to weep, Lord, you need tears to do it with. If you're going to wash somebody's feet, somebody's got to offer you that water. Lord, you're here, but you want to work through us and manifest yourself through us and make yourself known through us. But that you're here, there's no doubt in my mind. In fact, if our eyes were ever open, we'd dropped as one who's dead. Just the sheer fright, the panic, the fearfulness of it all. But you're here. Searching every heart, searching every motive. And here we sit so many times, Lord, with our indifference or rebellions. So simple to obey you. Lord, I think so many times that these people just see men up here. They don't realize that we're just your mouth, your hands, for just a moment in time, a very blessed moment in time. We are gathered here together unto you.